Hi, I'm Bill Arnold. Thanks for listening to the podcast. And a warm welcome to the show. So glad you're with me today. Bill Arnold here in studio. We're going to have a wonderful hour coming up. John Bloom is here with us already from DesiringGod.org. If you are a fan of that website, as I am, you know that there's tons and tons of fascinating articles written by very wise people. So we've got one of them in studio, and we also have John Bloom with us today. So wah, wah. Sorry, John. I couldn't resist that one. But anyway, I like weird words. So this is a great German word. It's called Gemütlich. Do you know any German? Anybody?
No.
No, I didn't think so. Anyway, Gemütlich. I hope to provide a Gemütlich atmosphere. That's a cozy, comfortable, pleasant, friendly place. That's what we hope to do in this hour. So if you have questions about anything, we'll take it. John's going to talk about the importance of words and how significant is our soul. And if you've ever had questions about your soul, we're going to talk about that. And it's going to be, we're going to go in depth. So we love scripture on this show. So we're going to have a scripture from Song of Songs. Awesome. Then we'll go to break.
Solomon's Songs of Songs. We rejoice in the delight in you. We will praise your love more than the wine.
God is always ready to give you another chance. Hi, I'm Dick Whitmer, General Manager of Faith Radio. The Bible says that we've all been irresponsible and missed the mark. But the free gift of God is eternal life in Jesus Christ our Lord. Pastor Rick Warren says guilt destroys our confidence, damages our relationships, keeps us stuck in the past, and even can hurt our health. But God doesn't want us to live there. Plus, He's provided a way out, and it's so simple. Admit that we have sinned. It won't shock Him or change His love for you. Repent and turn to God. And according to His word, you can expect complete forgiveness. And it happens instantaneously. No waiting periods to see if everything works out all right. Faith Radio is here to share God's good news. And part of it is coming to realize that God not only forgives us, but He frees us from the guilt and shame that comes with our mistakes. Thank you for praying and supporting this ministry. Together, we are making a difference for Christ. God bless you.
It is 6 minutes after the hour. So glad you're with me today. Bill Arnold here in studio with Rebecca Maxwell on the board. Awfully nice. And John Bloom. And John used to be in the famed McArnold group. And that sort of has broken up a little bit. Sad. But we can add Rebecca into the McArnold group. I think you should join. You should join in the McArnold group.
Have I been
today.
Nominated?
Yes. You just got nominated. Yes.
You guys really like me?
Well,
this
yeah.
is so cool.
Yeah, we like you. So we want you to be a participant as well in the discussion today.
Well, I'll try to listen and learn first, and then if anything comes to mind,
okay,
maybe that'll help.
That sounds good. And to all of you listening today, if you have a question, you know, we're going to talk about the soul. And John wrote an article for Desiring God, and it says, the one thing you must never lose. And we're going to talk about that. But if you have questions about your soul, feel free to call 877-933-2484. I was reading an article that C.S. Lewis said, but it turns out he didn't write it. George MacDonald wrote it, that you don't have a soul, you are a soul. You have a body.
Mm-hmm.
And that was attributed to Lewis, but apparently Lewis didn't write it. George MacDonald did.
Mm-hmm.
So you never know what you're reading and who you believe.
That's right.
Anyway, yeah. John, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Yeah.
It's good to be here.
Let's talk a little bit about the one thing you must never lose.
Well, I think what you know, that quote from MacDonald / Lewis, I think that's getting close to reality, because the Bible speaks of the soul in one of the reasons why I think there's a fair amount of confusion as to exactly what the soul is. You know, just you talk to Christians and there's various ways that they use soul. You know, some people really emphasize spirit, soul, and body.
Mm-hmm.
Because those are terms that the Bible uses. and others really just use the term soul and body. You know, I mean, there's more than that, but I mean, those are the two primary ways that people tend to talk about the soul. And they, you know, it's either spirit, soul, and body, or they just combine soul and spirit. And the reason that happens is because the Bible frequently uses soul and spirit synonymously.
Mm-hmm.
So let me just give you a couple examples. So if we here's the way it works linguistically. So if in the Old Testament, which is Hebrew primarily, the the word for soul that was translated in English as soul is almost always the word, the Hebrew word nephesh. And then if you go to the New Testament, mainly Greek, the word that is primarily translated to the English word soul is psyche. Now, spirit, if you go to the Old Testament, the Hebrew word for spirit is usually ruach. That's the word that we usually translate into the English word soul, ruach. And or in spirit, English word spirit, mm-hmm. ruach. And then in the Greek, written in the New Testament, it's usually pneuma. So, you know, that the spirit is pneuma. So so there's a linguistic distinction in the Bible between those two realities. And now here's where it gets a little fuzzy. Sometimes the Bible refers to those, to the spirit and the soul, as two distinct realities. So if you go back to Genesis, Genesis chapter 2, verse 7, when God creates Adam, it says that he created him, the King James says, he created him a living soul, or more modern translations will say living creature or living being. But the Hebrew word there is nephesh. So what that means is the encompassing all of what it means to be a person, body and, you know, inner man and outer man. So that's one way of using nephesh. And then in Ecclesiastes chapter 12, verse 7, it talks about the spirit as being something distinct. So the spirit, when the body dies, it says, and returns to dust, and the spirit returns to God who gave it. So there, spirit is distinct from body. So there you've got nephesh, which is kind of the whole being of the human. Spirit is distinct. But then there are times when spirit and soul are basically used synonymously in the Bible. So in the same book, Genesis, that talks about, you know, in Genesis 2, the whole being, body and spirit, soul. Later on, it talks about Rachel. Remember when Rachel's dying in childbirth?
Mm-hmm.
The same author says that as her soul, her nephesh, was departing. So that sounds very much like spirit. So sometimes it uses it synonymously. And you go to the New Testament, and here's where it's interesting. The Apostle John describes Jesus in chapter 12 as being troubled in soul, troubled in psyche. All right. And then the next chapter, in chapter 13, describes Jesus as being troubled in spirit, or pneuma. He means the same thing. He's not drawing distinctions. You can tell that he uses those two terms interchangeably. And so that's why there's a bit of confusion as to what the soul, the spirit distinction is.
I get it now. I mean, I look at these. John 12:27 says Jesus was troubled in soul, and then in John 13:21, troubled in spirit.
Right.
And Jesus himself told us not to fear those who can kill the body, but the soul.
Right. Right. So the Bible frequently just uses those terms, soul and spirit, interchangeably, which is why we tend to do that. That's why we tend to do that. And why I'm not one of those who draws a clear distinction between spirit, soul, and body. I mean, I do think, obviously, we do know as Christians, there is a distinction between the inner man, the soul, and the outer man, the body.
Mm-hmm.
But God didn't create us to be separate beings. He created us to be holistic beings. That's why we have a hard time imagining, like, as we are living in our bodies being separated from it. Okay, that because we are meant to be holistic. We are when we look at ourselves as our whole person, we are a nefesh or a psyche. That's who we are. That's our being. And mm-hmm. and Dallas Willard, I think is helpful. I find him helpful when he says the soul. When he's trying to get to what the soul is, he says the soul is the most important thing about you. It's who you are. It's the essential you.
Is it a mystery though, John? I mean, we talk about the soul, and we always say, well, our soul lives forever, and it's Dallas Willard saying it's the most essential you. I get that, but I don't know if I get it.
No.
Is it supposed to be kind of a mystery?
Well, yeah, it is supposed to be a mystery. Okay. And the reason is because, as I said, God made us to be one united being. We're meant to be we're meant to be soul and body united. You know, that's why we are who we are. That God created us the way we are. And it's why in the new creation, in the resurrection, we are not going to be disembodied souls. We are going to be embodied souls. That's the way God made us to mm-hmm. be, and that's why there's mystery. But here's let's go a little bit deeper into the mystery. We don't know exactly what life is. What I mean, we know what it is just by the experience of it. We can see it. We can observe. We observe it. Mm-hmm. But you talk to anybody who's got a PhD in the life sciences, and they're going to have trouble defining what life really is. What is it? What is life? Or if you talk to people with PhDs in the neurosciences, you're going to find people who have a hard time even describing what is consciousness. We can see it. We know it, what it is by experience, but we can't really define it. It's mysterious. And the reason let's talk about it. Why is that mysterious? It's mysterious because God's life is mysterious. Okay, so we can't explain God's life. God simply is. He's unfathomably is. And so that's why when he reveals to Moses on the mountain who he is, his most holy name, Yahweh, that means I am who I am. Or another way of saying it is I am reality. I am.
Mm-hmm.
And we are because God is. If we don't know that connection, we are unhinged and we have no idea of what life is. It is a mysterious thing.
Yeah. Well, this is Light Conversation. We're going to take a little break and we come back lots more with John Bloom from DesiringGod.org talking about the soul and the spirit. We got lots more to talk about. We'll be right back. Hour, Bill Arnold here with you. You know when you have a snow cone, you eat it too fast, and you get a brain freeze? Welcome to my world right now. We're talking to John Bloom from DesiringGod.org. We're talking about the soul and spirit. You must keep your soul. You say so, John. So is that our job, to keep our soul?
Well, yes. Excuse me. Yes, it is our job. I mean, it's not like we didn't bring ourselves into being. So in that sense, we are not ultimate. We are not God. We didn't create our souls. And so we don't ultimately hold them together. Mm-hmm. God does. He holds us together with the rest of creation by the word of his power. However, we know that we're to keep our souls because God tells us to.
Where's that?
Well, you can go back to Moses. There's lots of places where it talks about keeping your soul. But Moses, when Moses is delivering his final word to the people of Israel in the book of Deuteronomy, they're just about ready to go into the land. He knows he's not going in. He's giving his farewell address. And he says this in chapter 4, verse 9. He says, "Only take care, keep your soul diligently, lest you forget the things that your eyes have seen, lest they depart from your heart all the days of your life, and make them known to your children and your children's children." And so he's saying diligently keep your soul. And what does he mean by that? He means remember. remember what your life, who gave you life, where it comes from. Remember what life is all about. Remember what God tells you. Remember, don't forget. And so a way we can just enter into this is just to say, at its most essential, keeping your soul is remembering what's real, what's true.
Is the soul where you have made the most important decisions in your life?
Well, if we're right, and we say that the soul, according to the Bible, is the essential you, then yeah, that's where you make your most important decisions. I mean, it's the very essence of who you are, I think, is probably the most helpful way to say it. And we know that the body, or that our life is more than our bodies, because even the way we think about our bodies, we tend to think about our bodies abstractly. And when somebody passes away, we can tell there's a huge difference. Their body was precious to us, but when they've died, the essential them is gone. And so, I just forgot what your original question was. I was going down the road and...
Well,
that happens around here.
Yeah, because
I was meandering and realized...
That's okay.
Did I leave the path?
No, that's all right, because when you were talking, I was working on a crossword puzzle. So we had a couple of things going all at once, so it's A-okay. My question was, is it up to you to keep your soul?
Oh, yeah,
is it your job to keep your soul?
Yeah, that's what you said.
Yeah.
Yeah, and so... Yeah, you must keep your soul. That's what Moses says, and it's not just for the people of Israel. It wasn't just for them. It's for us. We are meant to keep our souls. You know, God, our life. God, so much of the Bible, if we talk about keeping your soul, is remembering. You think about the way in the Old Testament, the way the life of Israel, the corporate life, the religious life was structured, all those laws and sacrifices and all those things. I mean, there's all sorts of reasons for it, but it was this great corporate remembering. They were supposed to be reciting things and reciting to their children. When you get up, when you get up in the morning, and when you're walking on the way, and when you lie down, you know, recount these things, remember. And and you go to the New Testament and you've got the same thing. The structure of the church is all about remembering what the gospel is, who Jesus is, what life is all about. You know, so the ordinances, you take the Last Supper, as often as you eat this bread and drink this wine, you proclaim the Lord's death. Or Jesus says, do this
in remembrance of me.
Right. And so we get together, we sit under the teaching of the word so that we remember. Right, we remember. Mm. We hide the word in God's heart so that we might not sin against Him. So that we remember, because the biggest problem, as sinners, as fallen creatures who have this gravitational pull away from God, is we are forgetting. We're like leaky buckets. We're just forgetting, and so we've got to have things. Keeping our souls is keeping God in front of our face, keeping what's real in front of our face, keeping what's valuable in front of our face and in our hearts. Otherwise, we will do as Moses warned the people of Israel, and he said, lest these things depart from your heart all the days of your life. That's the danger. Exhort one another as long as it is called today, lest any of you be hardened by the deceitfulness of sin. Hebrews 3. Hmm.
And that seems like part of the concern there when it comes to this wonderful benefit of being able to recognize the soul and all the great heights to which we can soar, is that we might not recognize that we're not keeping our soul, that we're not remembering until after we've lost that.
Yeah.
So maybe, John, if you don't mind going into some of that, because that's my question. How do you know when you're not keeping your soul? Is it after you've already gone down the path, the wrong path?
Yeah, that's why the writer of the Hebrews says things like, don't neglect meeting together, as is the habit of some. If you neglect being with others who are all like the corporate remembering, you're liable to go off down paths on your own. We can kind of begin to adapt our own interpretations of things based on our own experience and preferences and things like that, that we and forget, really forget what the essentials are. We stay together and we say these things together because we help each other remember. The life of the church, much of the life of the church, is helping each other get to heaven. That's what we're doing. We're helping each other persevere to the end. And we do that by helping each other remember. What is this all about? And why?
Mm. Got a call that came in, Alex, from Walker, Iowa. He said, I think this is an important part of the conversation, is the issue of sin. People are struggling with, what is the definition of sin? Let's focus on how to be purified and untainted from the world through the power of Christ. So he was wondering maybe what a definition of sin was. Unfortunately, we go to break in a couple of minutes, so you're not a lot of pressure on you right now.
Yeah.
This is live radio.
Yeah, yep. Yeah, so not a lot of blank space, John.
I'm okay with silence.
Trying to remember, I'm trying to recall the text from Jeremiah, I think Jeremiah 2, where he says, my people have committed two evils. They have forsaken me, the fountain of living waters, and have hewn out for themselves cisterns, broken cisterns that can hold no water. And I think that is a very good description of what sin really is. They have forsaken me, the fountain of living water, and have hewn out for themselves their own cisterns, and they're broken.
Oh, wow. That's fantastic.
They can hold no water. And so they will never satisfy you, but you just keep going back, which is, I mean, I think that's a metaphor for what happened in the garden. They forsake God and hewed out for themselves a cistern, a broken cistern of the knowledge of good and evil that could hold no water. They could not keep it in. So yeah, I mean, that's how I think of sin. At its essence, it has a million manifestations, but at the center, it's seeking your putting your trust in and seeking your satisfaction in things that are not God and not from them, they're apart from him.
And as a result, it's death, because that's not where the life is.
It's death.
It's a denial of reality, like I think you said about 10 minutes ago.
Yeah.
I'm taking notes.
You remembered something he said from 10 minutes ago? That's fantastic. All right, we'll take a little break when we come back. Lots more with John Bloom. And the passage, John, is Jeremiah chapter 2, verse 13.
Thank you.
Yes.
Verse 13.
Yes. We'll take a short break and be back with more in just a minute. Gone very long. We're already back. Bill Arnold here with you. John Bloom is in studio. Rebecca Maxwell. We're kind of the new McArnold group, and we're just having a great time. We're talking about soul and spirit, and it's a fascinating conversation. And I don't know if I know I've learned a lot. If you have any more questions about that, you can certainly give us a call. We are going to move on in just a few minutes to another topic, another article John has written. Any closing thoughts on the soul and the spirit, John?
Yeah, well, because of what Moses said and the way the Bible talks about the keeping of the whatever you want to call it, the soul, spirit, the inner man or the inner person, the inner being, as Paul describes it, our number one priority is keeping the soul. That really needs to be our primary responsibility, because out of that flows everything else. If you that's why Jesus said, what good does it profit a man if he gains the whole world and he loses his soul? That's the danger. that's the danger. Don't lose your soul in your effort to gain the world.
Mm-hmm. John, let me ask you about the soul. I know when a person dies, we're very comfortable with the idea of soul travel. Soul leaves the body and travels to be in the presence of God. Is that right?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, what we know is, you know, to be absent from the body is to be present with us,
yeah,
with the Lord.
Right. And because our physical bodies are still here on earth, our soul has traveled to be in the presence of the Lord.
Yep.
That's how I understand things.
Yeah. I mean, what I do is I try to take Paul's exhortation in 1 Corinthians chapter 4 and apply it as broadly as I can, which is do not go beyond what is written. And so I don't get into a whole lot of speculation as to what that means.
Sure.
You know, we're talking about interdimensionality and all sorts of stuff that I don't, you know, it's beyond what God has revealed. But we do know that essential person, that inner being, that soul, that spirit departs from the body and goes to be, mm-hmm, as the writer of Ecclesiastes says, goes to God who gave it.
All right. And we have a conversation that goes like this. You can, in prayer, enter the throne room of God. What does that mean?
Well, it means that you know, God who is present everywhere, right?
Mm-hmm.
We understand the Bible to mean that, you know, as like Psalm 139 says, where can I go to flee from you? You know, no matter where I go, there you are, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so it doesn't take, you know, we're actually not outside of the presence of God at any point, whether we're conscious of it or not. And prayer is our intentional focusing on God and acknowledging it. And, you know, we describe it as going into the presence of God or into the throne room of God, simply because that's the limit of our language. You know,
mm-hmm,
that's a way of our saying we are turning our attention and we are intentionally bowing before Him or coming into His presence with reverence and worship and with our requests. And that's how I would describe it.
Mm-hmm. All right. You wrote a great article in desiringgod.org. You can check this out. It's entitled "God Doesn't Waste Words," and I completely agree. But sometimes it kind of feels like, what's that in there for? There are bits and pieces of information that doesn't seem to necessarily move the narrative along.
Yeah. So this article is going to go up at 7 p.m. tonight on the desiringgod.org site if people want to read it. It's not there now, so don't be frustrated if you go there. But it's after 7, it will be there. Well, here's the thing. The Bible is full of odd information, right? We all know that. You know, you read the book of Numbers. You know, there's all sorts of places in the Bible where you go, what is all this? Like, why do we need to know this information?
Mm-hmm. You know, the places we tend to avoid because it just seems like it's
a
road bump.
Great. My devotions has me in Numbers. Can't wait to count the plates, you know? And that's just like there's just all sorts of odd information in the Bible, and so we can kind of like, well, you know, this is kind of accumulate like clutter in your house. You know, it just kind of goes into the corners and fills up, and you're just like, well, you know, what I want to do is stay on the path, the clear path to the things that are important, like the refrigerator or whatever, and ignore those other things, If we think that way about the information in the Bible, we are likely missing out on a lot of things. And it's easy to do, but God doesn't have those things in the Bible to waste words. It's not clutter. It's not biblical clutter. He's got them there for all sorts of different reasons. And so, you know, I give an example from the book of John, the Gospel of John, chapter 21. In this article, and what I'm saying here is this story. It's the last chapter of the book of John, and it's an odd story. It's a post-resurrection account of some of the disciples who run into Jesus. Jesus appears to them, but it has all sorts of weird information that we would go, you know, John, if you'd had a good editor, this would have been unnecessary. One of those examples is he tells us that when, well, let's go back and just talk about what the story is. All right. So what you got is Peter and John and his brother James and Nathaniel and Thomas. You got them sitting around. It's Jesus has been raised from the dead. He's appeared to them two other times, but they're not sure when he's coming and going. So they're sitting there, and Peter says, "I'm going fishing. Like, I might as well do something productive." And so John tells us that there are seven disciples who are there. You know, Peter, and then he names five, and then he says, and then there were two other disciples. Doesn't name two, and they're in this room, and they go, and the other six go, "Oh, we'll go fishing with you." So they go fishing, and they spend all night fishing because that's what commercial fishermen back then would do. Because the goal is catch fish, sell it in the marketplace in the morning. They catch nothing all night. So then in the morning, day breaks, and there's a stranger on the shore, and he shouts, "You know, how's the fishing going?" And they go, "Now, have you caught any fish?" "No." And then he says, "You know, he's about 100 yards away." "Well, try the other side of the boat." And they do that. And they catch a whole bunch of fish. And at that point, John says, "It's the Lord." So Peter dives in, swims to shore. The others pull this huge load of fish in. Jesus serves them breakfast on the beach and then gives Peter some marching orders. So that's the essential story, mm-hmm. right? That makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so now let's go back. But I've just left out some pieces of that story. First of all, let's just go back and say, John includes... He says there's seven disciples, and he gives us the names of five. Well, why doesn't he give us the other two names? I mean, like, what did he do, run out of parchment? I mean, why five and not two? We don't know the answer to that question, but why? That's an odd bit of information.
I agree.
Right? So then the second odd thing is they're fishing. They don't recognize the voice of the person shouting from shore, which is odd too, because these are men who spent 3 years with Jesus. They know his outside voice. He's an outdoor preacher. They don't recognize that. But he says, you know, try the other side of the net. They do it. They probably do it because they go, "Hey, wait a minute. Oh, we've heard this before." And they catch it. And John says, "It's the Lord." And then he says this weird thing about Peter. He says, Peter put on his outer garment because he was stripped for work, and he threw himself into the sea. Well, why didn't it just say, "Oh, Peter got excited, and he dove in, and he swam to shore"? Why do we need to know anything about his wardrobe?
Mm-hmm.
And then the third thing is the fish. So the number of fish. We got 153 fish. He says that when they get to the beach, Jesus has breakfast prepared. Jesus says, "I want you to bring some of those fish that you caught," which I think is a little bit of the Lord's humor. And Peter goes and he hauls it in, and then John says he hauled the net to shore full of large fish, 153 of them. And although there were so many, the net was not torn. Have you ever stopped to think, why do we need to know there was 153 fish? Why? Why is that even there? Okay, obviously John's impressed by that. And John's impressed by it because he's a fisherman, right? But 99.999999% of his readers aren't going to have any context to know why 153 large fish is an impressive catch. So why is that there? That's the question. Why are those odd bits of clutter in that story? And here's what I want to suggest and why we don't want to pass over these things too quickly. Because those little bits of information are telling a story about the story. So what they're – and here's the story that I think it tells. This is the way an eyewitness – describes an account,
mm-hmm.
right? This is not the way a person who's imagining a story writes a story. Okay, so when somebody's telling you something, something that's happened to them, they're giving you an eyewitness account. They probably are including bits of information. You're like, I don't need to know all that,
right?
Right. So I don't like. Why are you telling me that? Well, the reason that they're telling you that is because their mind is conditioned to catch certain kinds of details because of their history and all sorts of things. We know that the person who told the story knows fishing. He was there to catch this odd thing about Peter and his clothes, you know, and it just logged in his brain. I don't know that John thought like, there's some great spiritual reason why I need to include this. Here's what I'm getting at. This account says something about the author. This author was an eyewitness, and this author knows something about fishing and knows something about Jesus and knew the disciples. These odd little things. Here's some names. Not just because he recognized the names, but the way he said it, just the offhanded way he just threw five names out there. The odd way he mentions the clothes, the odd way he mentions the fish. This is an eyewitness account. This is somebody who's been there. This is the way an eyewitness tells the story. Mm-hmm. So this is saying this is a story about the credibility of this account. This person was there.
It's interesting, John, because I look at, for example, Mark chapter 4. It talks about the story of Jesus right before he stills the storm. And we're told that he was sleeping on a cushion on the boat. Sleeping on a cushion? Why did they say he was sleeping on a cushion?
Yeah. Well, we know that Mark wasn't there, right? John Mark wasn't there. However, most biblical scholars believe that Mark was getting this from Peter, that really this is Peter's primary account.
Mm-hmm.
Peter was there. Peter notes this odd detail, right?
Mm-hmm.
He notes it. So he's a fisherman. He knows boats. He knows whatever. There's a cushion for people to sleep on or whatever, and he happens to note it.
Well, what about like even in John chapter 8 where Jesus saved the woman who was about to be stoned because she was caught in adultery, and he bends down and doodles in the sand?
Right.
We know nothing about what he doodled or what he wrote.
Right.
And how long it took.
Right. Somebody who saw
that.
Yeah. Like it's an odd bit of information.
It kind of is.
Yeah, it's an odd bit of information. And so we note things from the odd portions of the Bible. They're there. They may not be a part about the main part of the story, the main thing of the story. They may not be adding to the main point of a story, but they are saying something, in this case, about the nature of who's telling it. Who's telling it?
And
somebody who was there.
All right, we'll take a short break. If you have a question or a comment about this discussion we're having, you can give us a call, 877-933-2484. And we'll be back with John Bloom from DesiringGod.org in just a minute. Until the top of the hour, we're having a great conversation with John Bloom from Desiring God, talking about does God ever waste words? And obviously, the answer unanimously in this studio is no, he does not. But we do find it interesting because there are a number of what appears to be odd details as we read stories and read scripture where there are things like they pulled in the fish and there were 153. It's like, why did they include that? So paying attention to some of these bits of information, John, and there are a lot of them. Is it a good exercise to do that? Is it important for us to pay attention to these details?
It's very important.
Okay.
It's very important because those details are usually, as we said before, usually saying something about, in this case, the example we're using, it's saying something important about the author, about the credibility of this report. It has all those odd rings of authenticity that come with eyewitness accounts. But here's the oddest detail in the story. Okay, we haven't even gotten to the oddest one. The weirdest one is John makes this odd comment. He says, so they got to the shore. Everybody knows it's Jesus by now. They get to the shore. He's got breakfast. And then John just throws out this comment. Now, none of the disciples dared to ask him, "Who are you?" They knew it was the Lord. Have you ever thought, like, that is a weird thing to say? John's already established the fact that they know it's the Lord, But they get to shore, and there's something about him that John has to note. He just notes, and he doesn't go on to explain it. So it's not like it's a real important theological piece that he's going to unpack. He just throws it out there. No one dared to ask him, who are you? They knew, these are men who spent 3 years full-time with this person. You know, it's like, so there's something different about it. Why would God include that little thing if John's not even going to elaborate on what that exactly meant? There's all sorts of things that it could mean, but most of that is speculation. Well, I think one thing we can say is that corroborates with other accounts about people's meeting Jesus in his post-resurrection thing. And let's go right – I'll take you to one example. Luke 24 is the road to Emmaus. Remember that one?
Mm-hmm.
You got – here's another one where it names Cleopas and another disciple are on their way to Emmaus. And they go, and this stranger shows up and starts talking to him, spends most of the afternoon with them, explaining the whole Bible to them. And they don't know who it is, but they're amazed because he's explaining why Jesus must be the Christ, even though at the beginning of their conversation, it didn't even sound like he knew who Jesus was and what had just happened in Jerusalem, that he was crucified, etc. And so they get to Emmaus. It's time for dinner. And what happens? They don't recognize him until he breaks the bread. And all of a sudden they realize it's revealed to them. This is Jesus. And then he disappears. Now, there's similarities here between the story in John 21. The disciples didn't really recognize him until he revealed. How did they recognize him in the whole fishing thing? They recognized him when the fish filled the net. That's when they recognized him. This is the Lord. They recognized him in an act, a familiar act of Jesus. That really tipped them off to who this was. What happened in the road to Emmaus? They recognized him when he broke the bread. He revealed himself in the breaking of the bread. It wasn't, there was something about his post-resurrection nature that made him difficult or that he could even conceal kind of who he was because he's at this point transitioning them from trusting in his physical presence to trusting his word. They're going to have to trust him in other ways than the ways that they were used to recognizing him.
And that works when they remember. And the acts works. Of God.
Yes, precisely.
Callback.
Yeah,
precisely. Our earlier conversation.
Does that make sense? So this odd thing is corroborating. This odd thing in John chapter 21 is corroborating another eyewitness account. Mm-hmm. Similar things happened. Different authors wrote it. Different people experienced mm-hmm. it. It's very similar. So it's like you don't pass over those things too quickly because God has all sorts of reasons why he throws odd details in there, and they're meant to make us think.
Well, John, you're making me think right now, and one of the things that I think is maybe one of the reasons we go for main narratives in Christian environment in the church. We teach stories, and we try to grasp the main point. We might end up skipping over some of the details you're talking about, which you're pointing out are so important, precisely because maybe they might be confusing or seemingly contradictory. Mm-hmm. And it sounds like what you're saying is that it's actually the opposite. It helps corroborate and helps authenticate.
Yeah. At least we should press into them, ask the questions. Why is this here? Not just go, oh, it doesn't matter. Like, I don't even know what that means. You know, 153 federal, I don't know what that means. Well, whoa. If you don't know what it means, stop.
Exactly.
Stop.
Yeah.
Think. Ask questions. Why is this here? Now, you might not always come up with the answers, but you know, but that's what makes the Bible such a rich book. It is an amazing book. It is absolutely bursting with things that if you take time to press in, you take time to dig, to explore, to press into those corners that you think are clutter, you find things that you go, oh.
John, I'm looking back at this verse in John 21:12. Now, none of the disciples dared ask him, who are you? They knew it was the Lord. I'm going to struggle with that one. I'm going to chew on that one all night.
Yeah.
And again, it's a very odd thing to say because they recognized him.
But the way it's worded, you can tell that they kind of wanted to ask. Right?
Yes, yes.
Like,
it's like yeah.
You're who we think you are, right? I mean, like, you're you're Jesus. But,
right.
But no, we already know that.
But it's not like running into a Hollywood person after so much plastic surgery.
Right.
You know, are you Mickey Rourke?
So Jesus has a resurrection body. And when he's already appeared to them twice. These are guys who've seen him twice before since the resurrection, mm-hmm. and they're having a hard time. So, and the reason they feel, I think the reason there must be a struggle, I don't dare ask him, because they are already discerning. He's manifesting himself to us in a way that we must trust him. We must trust him. You know, for me now to go, you are who I think you are is probably, you know, a lapse of faith. I mean, I think there's a lot there. Mm-hmm. I mean, that would be one way I would explain why it's worth it.
I'm still struggling with seasoned fishermen going out, and then after a night of nothing, some guy from the beach is saying, do this, and they do it. They don't know it's the Lord at that point. Why would they follow some guy's advice from the beach?
Well, my answer to that is at this point, see, when this happened originally, they all, you know, Jesus, they knew who Jesus was. He was a prophet, remember? So he had been teaching. He says, push out to the shore, whatever, and, you know, and you'll catch some fish. And Peter said, well, we've been fishing all night. We didn't catch anything. But since you say it, Jesus will do it. And they go and they catch the fish. Well, this time they're out there and they hear this. Throw your nets. I think they probably went, we've heard that before.
Oh.
We've heard that before.
Was it just the words or was it a voice?
Just the instruction.
Like, okay.
Cast your nets on the other side and you will find some. Oh, we've heard that before. Could this be? You know, I don't think they would have done it if it was just some schmo. But something caught them and went, let's try this because this just might be.
Yeah. So when we're faced with a passage, it seems like it's either challenging or maybe just contains these unnecessary little bits that we don't want to have to deal with or stumble over or we're tempted to ignore. How should we approach them?
Well, I think what you do is you need to just stop and ask, why is this here? You know, that's part of what meditation is. Meditation often is asking questions of the text. That's like when you said it's part of remembering. It is part of remembering. It's part of noticing. Like we have to cultivate a habit of noticing, or else we'll stay in familiar ruts of the things that we know, and we'll just stay in those ruts. We must cultivate noticing, because these are there for a reason. So we have to stop. That will take some work, because part of us isn't going to want to have the patience to stop and ask questions about them, because we just assume there's not much there to see.
You know, John, I look at some of this, like, for example, in Mark chapter 4, I know we're out of time, but when Jesus, right before he calms the storm, he's sleeping on a cushion in the boat. And my brain doesn't go to what's with the cushion. My brain goes, if there is a raging storm, how in the world is anyone sleeping?
Yeah, and I would say Jesus sleeps because he knows who's in charge of the storm.
Yeah. I mean, you can't sleep on a plane when there's turbulence, can
No.
you?
No.
How on a raging
No.
sea, when everyone thinks they're going to die,
Right.
you're sound asleep
Right.
down below.
Yeah, I love that.
Doesn't the sheer force of everything throw you out of your bed?
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah.
John, I love having you in studio. Thanks so much for coming in. You can see John's writings on the desiring.org website, desiringgod.org. This article that we're talking about is going to be up live at 7 o'clock tonight. You can go check it out. And if you like this interview, pass it on to a friend. Go to myfaithradio.com, and you can send this on or listen to it again. Such good stuff. John, thanks so much for coming in.
Great to be here.
And the McArnold Group has been semi-resurrected. Rebecca Maxwell has done a fine job.
Happy to serve where I can.
Yes, and that other Peter guy that was once in the group, well, we miss him.
All right.
Thanks so much. That wraps up our show for the night. Have a great evening, and God bless you. I'll see you tomorrow. Thanks for listening. Programming like this is made available through your support. Information available at myfaithradio.com.